Welcome everyone to the third of these talks on diffraction and imaging. The subject I want to address today is trying to get information about some microscopic object, perhaps as small as a molecule, by scattering. Now, the problem with an object that small is that it is difficult to get enough photons to scatter off it. In fact, one has to go to something like the free electron laser, which produces such a huge number of photons. And even then, with a molecule that small, you don't expect more than, let's say, 100 photons to be scattered from the entire molecule if it's a big, if it's a large protein. But the problem with that is that you have to put so many photons into the molecule that you'll definitely destroy the molecule. Now, the way that traditional crystallography overcomes this is by arranging these tiny molecules in a periodic array to form a crystal. As a result, the number of photons that need to be scattered off any one molecule is actually quite small.
Sorry, can you mind clarifying this point you started with?
Sure.
Which is, you said only 100 photons are scattered.
Scattered. What I mean is detected on a typical detector.
In one sort of detector position, or do you
I meant in one detector position. I mean, you can do a calculation and estimate how many photons are likely to be detected from a typical flux you expect from a free electron laser from a typical protein, which is I define as a 500 kilodalton protein. And that's about 100 photons, roughly speaking. Not per pixel, over the whole pattern. Is that what you meant? No.
Well, 100 photons seems like this. We did a calculation on the Nabisco molecule. Uh-huh. It's about 10 to 4.
Okay, so I don't know how big that molecule is.
It's relatively large.
Okay, that's probably it. I mean, the larger the molecule, the more scattering you have.
Yeah.
Right? So, I'm talking about, I think we did the calculation for a 500 kilodalton protein, and then it's about 100. But it's of that order.
That's under what solid angle?
Roughly a angle of about 30 degrees, you know, scattering angle of about 30 degrees. That's pretty much right. This is just a rough number, okay. But the problem is, if you scatter so many photons off a single molecule, you will certainly destroy it. John Spence has estimated that you are about 20 times the damage threshold with a typical free electron laser. So if you want to image a molecule without damaging it, and there might be reasons for doing that, then it is necessary to scatter off a fair number of molecules so that you can keep the number of photons scattered per molecule down below the damage threshold. Now, this is done, of course, in conventional crystallography. There you have identical molecules arranged in a lattice, and then the number of photons scattered per molecule is actually well below the damage threshold, and so the crystals survive for a while, at least, while you're taking your diffraction patterns.
Your Honor, can you define the damage threshold in crystallography? Because in this lattice, I think the situation is fundamentally different, right?
Uh-huh.
Because you absorb relatively few photons per shot.
Uh-huh.
You give the system time, if you cool it, that's what you do often in proton crystallography, you make the system cold because uh-huh. you get some kind of macroscopic heat from shot to shot. So you can carry away some of the heat and make the system recombine and get back down to some degree to the ground state, which is not possible with a single shot experiment, right? When you just blow it apart, and there's uh-huh. no way to carry away the heat, so to speak, the system will eventually fragment.
That's right.
This point, I think the predominant effect is not due to the time scale of relaxation, but that the fact that in a crystal, the probability for any single molecule is very small to be hit by a photon. You collect that data from so many copies that even if you had the hit and destroy, that would still give you the information. You don't care. If you work out the numbers, it's into this equal copies. You distribute it over so many.
Then you basically get, of course, coherent enhancement because it's a crystal, right?
Yeah.
So they scatter in place.
It's sort of in distributing always the same guy, you know, for squeezing out information from this single molecule again and again. You say so no unit cell will scatter two photons.
That's right. But when you find damage threshold, I think we're asking about how much energy is dumped into one molecule in the crystal.
Exactly.
And so it's really this question about what is the damage, so to speak, suffered by any molecule in the crystal.
Yeah.
And now comparing that with taking just a single molecule
instead of an environment of a bunch of copies.
And so the statement seems to be that one can pump more energy into that isolated molecule than into the crystal.
No, what I'm saying is, at a typical X-ray free electron laser, you will, in order to get a measurable signal, a signal that's useful in a typical X-ray free electron laser, if you scatter off a typical protein molecule, the number of photons that hit that molecule definitely cause damage. I mean, this is Neutzer's paper.
Times I've heard that people claim that one can actually push the damage threshold higher, that you can actually still get structural information, which at the same dose you wouldn't get from a crystal. In other words, there's some degree of deterioration in the crystal already at a lower dose, in spite of the damage
I want to clarify that point. The point about a crystal is that you can keep the number of photons that hit any particular molecule, as Tim says, so low that you're below the damage threshold for that particular molecule, for any particular molecule. But one of the problems is that in a crystal, as White pointed out yesterday, you sample the scattered intensity only at certain discrete points, the so-called Bragg points. So you have a diffraction pattern like this, you don't get a continuous distribution, you sample the intensities only at discrete points. So this already is some loss of information, and as White pointed out yesterday, there really isn't enough information in a typical diffraction pattern to directly invert it to get a structure without additional information. Now, one of the advantages, of course, of scattering from a single molecule is that the intensity distribution is completely diffuse. This allows you to do the kind of oversampling tricks that the diffraction imaging people use in order to directly solve the phase problem. So that's why people are interested in this single molecule experiment at the XFEL. But the question I want to address today is whether you can take advantage of scattering from a large number of molecules and thereby stay below the damage threshold and still get this diffuse intensity distribution that allows you to use a phasing algorithm. Now, this is possible if the molecules, if the individual molecules are kind of random, random positions and random orientations, then there's no coherent enhancement in the Bragg directions, there's no perfect destructive interference between the Bragg spots. You will still get a diffuse intensity distribution, but it will be complicated because these molecules are in all kinds of orientations. So if it is possible to extract structural information from randomly oriented molecules, then it may be possible to use an X-ray source which isn't as intense and thereby doesn't damage the molecules and yet provides enough information for you to recover the structure because you have multiple molecules. That's the question I want to address. Now, what we, in the last couple of years, what we have found is that if you have a certain amount of orientational order in these molecules, so for instance, if you have molecules that were aligned by some electric field such that it's a certain axis of the molecule is aligned parallel to it, even if you have random azimuthal angles of the different molecules, you can still extract enough information from that molecule in order to solve its structure. And we have considered two cases. One, where the X-ray beam is incident along the alignment axis, and also the other case where X-ray beams are incident perpendicular to the alignment axis. And in both cases, you can get some very useful information. In this case, you can get what's called an azimuthal average. So what this means is you take the structure and you average it around here and you represent that with in cylindrical coordinates by two axes. And, so if you got a carbon nanotube, for instance, you would get this, this kind of shape. A capped carbon nanotube or something like that. If you have a spherical shell, you'd expect to get that kind of pattern. That's with X-rays incident perpendicular to the alignment axis. But today I want to concentrate mainly on the other case where X-rays are incident parallel to the alignment axis. Now, this is a possibly real situation, and I illustrate this with this first slide here. In a typical cell membrane, which consists of this bilipid layer, there are embedded in this membrane so-called membrane proteins, which play very important functions in real life. In fact, it's estimated that the vast majority of drugs on the market target these membrane proteins. So it's very important to learn about these. Now, some of these membrane proteins have pores in them that allow the passage of molecules from inside the cell to outside and vice versa. And they're a very important class of such molecules called the ion channel proteins. Now, the point about those proteins is that because they have this pore in the middle, they naturally align with the pore perpendicular to the membrane plane. Now, they are in random positions in this membrane, and they're in random azimuthal angles, but they are still aligned with one axis. Yeah.
So, if one has this membrane present, mm-hmm. it will also contribute to the scattering.
That's right. Sure. I will address that. So basically, the answer to that is you're quite right. It does contribute to the scattering, but If you are interested in relatively low resolution and you just want to determine, say, the shape of the protein, then that scattering is unimportant because it scatters to wide angles, and therefore you can ignore it if you're interested in relatively low resolution. Now, it's possible that we may be able to push the resolution higher, in which case we'd have to take that into account. Okay, but we'll come to that later. So that's the problem I'm going to address. If you have a set of molecules that are naturally have this partial alignment, is it possible to discover the structure of the individual molecule from a diffraction pattern from this ensemble of molecules? Now, here is a proposed experiment that Tim Saldi talked about. I know he does this kind of experiment. You create what's called a black lipid membrane. This is basically a hole in a material such as Teflon, and you paint these lipids such that they form a thin membrane across it, and then you can send X-rays in perpendicular to it and measure a diffraction pattern. Now, if you could arrange for this membrane to contain membrane proteins of a particular type, my contention is that they will tend to align such that the pore is perpendicular to the membrane, but in other ways it's disordered. Probably Tim can answer that.
because if you do, if you observe that optically, you have thickness of the membrane that is smaller than the wavelength of light, and so the two signs of the refractive index of the two interfaces cancels in phase, and that's why it looks.
It looks black.
It looks black. So yeah. When people did this for the first time, they sort of call it like black liquid membrane. You start from the thick one, and then it thins, and you have Newton fringes, and at some point it doesn't reflect anymore because you know you have the two mirrors which coincide with plus minus.
Okay. So that's the situation, and if you have X-rays incident perpendicular to the membrane, you form a diffraction pattern, they say, in the far field, and in that case, provided there's not too much of a curvature of the Ewald sphere, what you would expect is the projected electron density, and that's the best you can expect, the projected electron density of the molecule. So what we are going to see is whether it is possible to recover this projected electron density from an experiment such as this. Now, this is a famous example of an ion channel protein. This was actually solved by X-ray crystallography. The people who solved this did a heroic experiment and did actually manage to crystallize this. This is rather unusual. It's not usually possible to crystallize membrane proteins. This is a group led by Roderick MacKinnon, and I believe he won the Nobel Prize a few years ago for solving this structure. This is a very important protein. You see in the middle there, this cutout, there's a hole in the middle, and that's the hole through which the ions travel from inside to outside the membrane. So if we can determine the structures of this and similar membrane proteins, without having to crystallize them, this would be a great advantage.
What's the scale across the structure?
Let me go back. Roughly 100 angstroms, I would say. And that's a typical width of a protein molecule. Okay. So let me summarize then. The main points about this is that if you've got a disordered array of molecules, I mean, I know it's got partial order, but mostly it's disordered, you don't expect Bragg spots. So you expect a smooth distribution of intensities. This helps you actually to solve the structure, because as White said, you have more information because you don't only have information at the Bragg spots. Now, if you have such a situation, imagine now a set of objects which are randomly oriented about an axis parallel to the incident X-ray beam. Suppose one of these objects produces a complicated diffraction pattern, but let's look at one ring on the diffraction pattern. Suppose for the sake of argument that this ring has only two peaks, those two peaks on the top there. These two peaks here. Now let me form the autocorrelation of that pattern. What you do is you take a copy of it and then you move the copy relative to the original, and this creates an autocorrelation function. And let me do that. In this position, two of the peaks overlap, so you get value 1, here you get value 2, you get value 1, you go back to 0. So this is what the autocorrelation function of a two-peak distribution looks like, roughly. Now the next point is, suppose we have two such molecules. One molecule gives rise to these two peaks, and another molecule gives rise to these two peaks. And it doesn't matter what the relative orientation of these two is. We could put it here. If I take a copy of this intensity, this four-peak intensity distribution, put it on this inner circle, and again do the same thing, go through this correlation function calculation, it would produce an autocorrelation that looks like this, which is identical to the previous autocorrelation except scaled by a factor of n, where n is the number of particles. So here is the crucial point. If you were to take a set of intensities from a real experiment of molecules with this kind of random relative orientation and form the ring autocorrelation functions, the autocorrelation function doesn't depend on the number of molecules apart from a simple scaling factor and it doesn't depend on the relative orientations of these molecules. And what is more, this autocorrelation function gives you the information about an individual particle. So if you could somehow decode this autocorrelation function, you should be able to recover the diffraction pattern of a single particle. That's the idea. Yeah.
Can you just interject something?
Yes.
It is important, though, that you should expect some reasonable fraction of the molecules to scatter a pair of photons into the detector. Right? So you have these two.
Yeah.
Blue counts.
Yes, yes.
Those come from one molecule.
Yes,
and
yes.
The
absolutely.
Magenta counts come from
absolutely
some other molecule.
Absolutely.
So that actually, doesn't make your flux, from the free electron laser get too low.
Yeah, right. You're right. Yeah. You're right. But I pointed out.
Just to put it in perspective, right, with the previous number, we said if we let the full fury of the FEL photons on one molecule,
right? You get about 100 photons.
Right?
Right.
So if we want to get of order one or two,
No.
We should reduce that flux, not by a huge amount, but maybe just by a factor of 100.
Right. This is why I mentioned that John Spencer's estimate is that we're about 20 times the damage threshold. So if you divide 100 by 20, you still get a reasonable number.
Right.
Damage threshold depends on the situation. Mm-hmm. I think what defines a damage threshold in crystallography is not the same thing as the damage threshold.
I mean, this is a rough estimate, so maybe I'm off by a few factors or something, but it's not really critical. I mean, get 1,000 photons scattered per molecule in the X-FEL, you divide that by 20 or even 100, you still get enough scattering in order to form these autocorrelations, and I'll come back to this point later.
There's some theoretical calculation and exhibition experiment that there's some difference.
I'm just quoting John Spence. Yeah, I don't know what his source is, but since he's an expert in this.
Experimental, I think, for sure.
Yeah.
Just according to the recent results.
Yeah.
Right. Which is not well understood. That's what we learned last week. Why there's a little damage, so to speak. But the resolution was not as high. And this might explain it, this discrepancy, because either it was at 10 or 12 kV. These experiments where I guess a 2K equals 8 astrum resolution.
This is exactly presumably why crystals are so radiation sensitive, because only in crystals you reconstruct to 2 angstroms or below. So they are very, very, I mean, they have the highest quality standards.
Right, and when you say there's radiation damage in crystallography, you don't mean that you've actually exploded the protein.
No, it means that the outermost reflections decay.
That's why I mean that radiation damage, what one means by radiation damage in crystallography is fundamentally something very different from what one does to these core isolated molecules in the
form of
nebula.
Yeah. You may be right, but
you have to qualify on which scale you mean radiation damage.
At the moment, I'm only talking about relatively low resolution, but we'll see. Maybe with the use of White's algorithms, we can push the resolution much higher later on. But at the moment, we've got relatively low resolution.
I learned a couple of months ago, and I was shocked by that each molecule is different anyway, each biological molecule. So to which resolution is it meaningful to solve?
Right. So, at relatively low resolution, there isn't a lot of. We will see in a minute. I'm talking about 5 or 6 angstroms resolution. Maybe 8 angstroms.
Higher resolution.
I mean, I'm not getting down to atomic resolution at the moment.
The thing that makes it a little easier for us is we know it to a relatively low resolution because we know the building blocks of these molecules.
Right.
We can infer. Yeah, the high resolution thing consistent.
Yeah.
It's only so many.
Right.
Maybe like the atoms or whatever.
Yeah, this is even done in conventional.
Right. You get a low resolution thing, you know the sequence, you know how to grab the sequence. But with the constraint being that it builds up these low resolution models.
But if there are conformational differences, then those would be on a larger scale, right? We're not talking about minor differences on an atomic scale because for the same.
We're not talking about that.
The atomic scale is actually the same.
I'm not talking about the atomic scale right now.
Well, yeah. But what I'm saying is it's not the atomic scale that is the issue, it's already at a longer scale.
Yeah.
At lower resolution, that I think you will see differences between
the quantum. There are plenty of experiments which are done on proteins in solution. For example, these are called small angle X-ray scattering sacks experiments, in which one assumes that there is some variation in the molecular conformations, but they're uniform enough for you to recover quite a lot of details about the molecule.
So, membrane proteins are in quite stable folds for their function, right? So I wouldn't worry about conform conformation space too much.
At least until they get to
protein to protein. Yeah. But the potassium channel got the Nobel, the structure got the Nobel Prize because you could really figure out how the channel would allow potassium to go through and a larger sodium would be blocked. And this is entirely due to this precise nature. If that would vary from molecule to molecule, I mean, unless
it wouldn't work.
The enzyme has different states, then you want to make sure they're all in the same states. But I think
I think there's a question. There's a question at the back.
I thought that this time scale for folding and unfolding of proteins was, say, picoseconds. It's not. No, it's faster.
No, that's not the point. The point is that we're not talking about
it. If one did single, if one could do single shot imaging and get the full structure for a single shot, it would be a different thing. But if you take an ensemble, then you already potentially average to the different conformations. Or maybe not, depending on system.
And
the other thing is, if you do it with single shots and single objects, then you still have to accumulate data, and then you're going to average over, potentially, against the
Okay, so this is my claim, that if you could measure a multiparticle diffraction pattern with this degree of disorder, it's possible to recover a diffraction pattern of an individual particle without the Bragg spots. So you get a continuous distribution, which allows you to use a phasing algorithm on it.
Do you consider this interference from different molecules?
Yes. I'm coming to that. Yes, I do. And it survives even that. As I will show in a minute. So now I'll do some algebra to show you this. So the reason the interference between different molecules is unimportant is because they're in random relative positions relative to one another. So they give rise to random phases. And therefore, the resulting pattern is to a good approximation, actually just the sum of intensities rather than sum of amplitudes, because the interference terms all cancel out. I'll show you mathematically in a minute. But I'm making another point. Even if it's not, I think it still holds. But as I will show with this piece of algebra. Okay. So what I'm suggesting is that you take this pattern and you form from it what is called a pair correlation. So let me define what I mean by this. Let me call this C2 Q primed delta phi. And this function is defined as 1 upon n phi sigma j sigma omega, I'll explain these symbols in a minute, I q phi j omega minus I sacs, I'll explain this also in a minute, times sigma omega primed I q primed phi j plus delta phi omega primed minus I Sachs Q, and I'm assuming I'm averaging this quantity over all the diffraction patterns I measure. So the idea, the experiment is that if you have this membrane, you focus your X-ray beam onto a relatively small number, say 10 or 100 proteins, then move to a different region of the sample to get a different statistical ensemble, then to a different one, and you do this about 100 times. And you calculate this function from every pattern, and then you average this function over all the patterns. Okay, now let me explain this formula here. So what this is saying is, if I have a diffraction pattern from this disordered ensemble, and suppose I have a resolution ring, this is a ring in the detector space, magnitude Q, and another ring in the detector space, magnitude Q primed, I take the intensity at this point here, which may be at an angle phi j, say, and the intensity here, which is at an angle, let's say, phi j plus delta phi, the delta phi is some parameter, and I do this average over all the pixels, such as to keep the relative angle constant, but go right around this ring, and so basically I take the intensity here, I subtract from that the mean intensity on this ring, which is what I call I Sachs. It's just I bar. Maybe I should just call it I bar for this audience. The mean intensity on this ring. No. This first one is just Q. The second one is for Q prime. Call this. I'm sorry. This one should have been Q prime. You're right. I bar Q prime. So what I'm doing is I'm taking the intensity at this point, I'm subtracting the average around this ring to look at the fluctuations of the intensity above the mean, and taking the intensity at this point here on a different ring, I'm subtracting the average of that ring to look at the fluctuations there, and I'm summing this over all the phi j's, such as to keep the relative angle between the two constant at delta phi. And that forms for me a pair correlation function that depends only on the relative angles between these two. They can be in different rings, but the relative angle has to be the same. So, but this is a function that I can easily evaluate from a set of experimental data. So omega here is the orient. So remember, what I'm saying is that this pattern arises from scattering from an ensemble of particles. So omega is actually the orientation of the particle, of a particle, a single particle. This is why I sum over all the omegas to sum over all the particles. Okay. So this is an expression. This is a theoretical expression. Right. In an experiment, this sum is already done. So there is no omega here. You're just Q phi, and this is Q prime phi prime. Yes. Yeah. Orientationally correlated. I haven't considered that case. I'm talking about a relatively dilute array of proteins. So that, yeah. So there, yeah. For the sake of analysis, we need to refine this theory for other cases. Okay, so this quantity is as White says, there's no sum here over omega in experiment. So this can be measured, this can be measured, this can be measured, that can be measured. You can take this quantity, average it over all the diffraction patterns, and form this correlation function. They can be in the same ring, then you just put Q equals Q primed. But this is the more general formula. I'll show you in a minute why we might want to use information in different rings. Okay, so the rest of it is just some algebra. So I'm going to make use of the following fact. The intensity I at the point Q phi j obviously is equal to the modulus square of the amplitude at scattered to this point, J. Now I'm going to use, for convenience, a circular harmonic expansion. So the intensity I'm going to represent as sigma m I m q e to the I m phi j, and the amplitude I'm going to represent by another expansion, by m primed, a m primed q e to the I phi j. Now, we'll see in a minute why this is helpful. So now I'm going to make no assumption that this is, I'm going to actually add the amplitudes to produce this expression here. So White made this very good point. You don't know the orientations of the particles in an experiment,
yeah.
Right? This is just a theoretical expression. So, I mean, experimentally, this is Ix q phi j. This is all you know from the experiment. You have no idea what the orientations are. But in order to evaluate, in order to estimate this quantity theoretically, we need to assume that there are omegas in random orientations. Sorry.
So are you saying this cylindrical harmonic expansion refers to this experimental intensity, which has no omega dependence anymore?
Yes.
To I,
yeah.
X.
Good point. Yeah. I'm going to subtract off the average in a minute. Yeah.
Well, the average doesn't
happen. It's not interesting.
Yeah.
The average is not interesting, so we subtract it off. Okay. Now, that's a very good point. We're talking about this is an expansion of the experimental intensities of a single diffraction pattern. This is my assumption. On a single diffraction pattern, the intensity is just a function of Q and the angle phi, and it can be represented by this circular harmonic expansion. And if I were able to find these coefficients here, I would have the full 2D intensity distributions of a single particle. And what I'm going to try to show is that it is possible to recover these coefficients from a diffraction pattern with multiple particles with this degree of disorder. Now, okay, and this is very crucial. This is the single particle diffraction pattern. Of course, what you have experimentally is not a single particle one, it's a multiple particle one. So we need to somehow relate this, this single particle, call it S, this single particle quantity to that. Now, this is why I introduced this quantity omega. So suppose each particle has an orientation omega, and omega is a random number. So this allows you to have random orientations. So the S particle, say, has orientation omega. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take essentially expressions like this, substitute into there, evaluate this expression, and we'll see that it simplifies a lot. Now, actually, I'm going to do a little bit more than that. I'm not going to work with the intensities of a single particle, because in a coherent diffraction experiment, each particle scatters amplitudes, and you need to add up amplitudes. So I'm going to assume this expression, with minus omega, this being the orientation. This would, let's say this is the amplitude scattered by a single particle. Okay, I'm going to take this expression, substitute to form this thing, and then simplify this whole expression. Now this, the algebra is a bit long-winded, so maybe I'll cut some steps and we can discuss this later if you don't believe me. So here's my claim, that this quantity, I'll call it x of q phi j minus the mean value I bar of q, can be shown in terms of these amplitude coefficients to be equal to the following expression. Sum over n, sum over capital N, not equal to zero. I'll explain this in a minute. A m star q a m minus m q exponential minus I capital N phi j times these factors which depend on the orientations of the individual particles, exponential I m omega k exponential minus I m minus m omega k primed. These are orientations of the particles which I need to sum over, and I need to sum over the positions of the particles because there's interference. This is the position of the kth particle and this is the position of the k primed particle. Let's see, we need that factor also. So I think you can see that you should get an expression something like that. Now, the reason I put m not equal to zero is basically to subtract off the mean value. So it's like subtracting off the DC term. Okay. So this then would be an expression for one of these quantities here. And similarly, there's another expression for the Q prime quantity, which I won't write out, but you can see it's essentially of the same form, except this phi j gets substituted by phi j plus delta phi, and the Q becomes a Q primed, and otherwise it's much the same.
So yeah. When there are lots of omegas, yeah, they acquire basically continuous distribution of omegas,
right,
then I think this should probably become entirely phi j independent.
Omega j independent, you mean?
Well, if one has, if one evaluates.
Right. No, you're right. You're right. So what you're saying is that if I look at the intensities on a ring and you expect fluctuations if you've got a relatively small number of particles, if you've got a very large number, these fluctuations get smaller and smaller. Right, this I agree with. So there is a practical limit as to how many particles you can include. That's why I said you focus on a particular part of the membrane so that there's maybe 100 particles at a time. It's true that the fluctuations get smaller relative to the mean as you add more and more particles. So this is an experiment that you want to perform on a relatively small number of particles. But if you can do that, okay, so you get that expression, then you get a similar expression for the other quantity, substitute everything in, and then you just do some algebra. You sum over j first, and you sum over j first, this is the only quantity that depends on j. You get a delta function involving the m's, and let's see. Yeah, okay, let me write. Yeah.
What's the meaning of the index k?
K it just specifies a particle. So these particles, the only difference between the different particles is their orientation. So this is omega k means the orientation of the kth particle, or the k prime particle, or whatever. And I need k's and k primes and such like because this enters as a square.
So you can really sum over k and k prime.
I'm sorry, did I forget that? Yeah, sorry, there should be a sum over. Right, you're right. K and K prime, yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah. And in the other quantity, we get a sum over, say, K double prime and K triple prime, because you have to keep all these things completely random. Okay. So the expression is huge, but it simplifies. And the reason for the simplification is first you do the sum over it's also real. It's got to be a real intensity. You can easily show that it's real because you get complex conjugate pairs. So believe me, you can simplify this. It would probably take me longer than the time of this lecture to put in all the algebra. But so you first do the sum over j. This gives you a delta function involving the m's. Then you get an expression. Let me write that intermediate expression. So after doing the sum over m's and getting the delta function, this whole thing reduces to the following. C2 of q q primed delta phi equals, you still have an average of diffraction patterns, but one of the m's goes away because of the delta function, but you still have sum over m, m primed, a m star q, a m minus m q, and then from the other ring we get another factor of a m primed, a m primed minus m primed, sorry, this becomes an m because of the delta function, times exponential I m delta phi. So bear with me for a minute. this simplifies a lot in a minute, as I show. We have a sum over k, k prime, and we have a sum over k double prime, k triple primed. And here we have basically exponential factors that depend on the orientations and the positions of the particles. Now here's the crucial point. Because these are exponential factors, the off-diagonal terms basically average to zero. So you're left with only the diagonal terms in the orientations. So this means that you can replace this whole big factor here by just a factor of NP, the number of particles, because the diagonal terms are just unity. Right, the off-diagonal terms have phase factors which are random.
It crucially depends on the orientations being completely uncorrelated. The one that is slightly correlated.
I think this is the point of this average over diffraction patterns. So maybe it depends on that. We need to discuss that. But in practice, we have found if you use a random number generator for random angles, and you do this average over diffraction patterns, all those off-diagonal terms actually do vanish. And you simply get a factor of NP. Now, so the final expression that you get will look something like this. NP, the number of particles, times, another point is this. This quantity here is actually just IM of Q. And this quantity here is actually IM of Q primed. You can easily show that, but right, because one is the square of the other, modulus square. So the final expression you get for this correlation function is sigma m not equal to zero, it's always not equal to zero because you subtracted off the mean, of I m q, let's say I m star q primed, times this exponential factor, exponential I m delta phi. So this whole big expression simplifies to that. And of course, it's because of the cancelling of the off-diagonal terms. But here I want you to look at this expression. This is crucial. This tells you that the correlation, the angular correlation function from this ensemble of particles depends only on these quantities IM, which are characteristic of a single particle diffraction pattern, the intensity expansion coefficient of single particle diffraction pattern. Of course, they're multiplied by NP. That was the same factor I was explaining on the view graph. It just scaled up by the number of particles. And there's this exponential factor. So I pointed out that what we want to do is recover these IM of Qs, because you recover them, you recover the single particle diffraction pattern. So how do you do it? All you do is you take this pattern, this C2, and take a Fourier transform of this with respect to the delta phi quantity. So that will be, I'm sorry, this is a capital M. So that you take the nth Fourier coefficient of that with respect to delta phi, this will turn out to be just NP times IM of Q IM of Q prime star, right? Because this exponential factor goes away when you take the Fourier transform. Now, if Q equals Q prime, this is particularly simple. So Fourier transform, the mth Fourier coefficient of the C2 function, when Q equals Q prime, when you're on the same ring, is just equal to the number of particles times the modulus square of I n of Q. So you've already got some information about single particle diffraction pattern. You take the angular correlations, take its angular Fourier transform. This gives you essentially these coefficients here. At least it gives the modulus of those coefficients. Now, in the expansion I talked about, the diffraction pattern of a single particle, which is this expansion here, maybe I've got it, I m q e to the I m phi, these IMs are actually complex coefficients. So just knowing the modulus square is not enough. Right? This only gives the modulus of these numbers. So you need to recover the phases of those complex numbers in order to recover the single particle diffraction pattern. Now this is where Wright's talk yesterday is highly relevant, because this is another case of a problem where you know the amplitude, you don't know the phases. So how would you try to recover the phases? What you would do is you would start with the magnitude, but add to it some random phase, I'll call it phi m, right, to get a first estimate of the intensity distribution. Of course, it'll be completely wrong because it's random numbers. Then you apply some kind of constraint in this space, which is the diffraction pattern space, not the correlation space. So what kind of constraints can you apply? I mean, for instance, you could try a positivity constraint. Maybe there are stronger constraints, but at the very least, you have positivity constraint. Apply that constraint, transform back, you get a set of the same coefficients, now with phases. You keep the phases, you replace the amplitudes by the amplitudes that come from the correlation function, the experimental correlation function, and you go back and go round and round this loop. Probably there are more sophisticated ways of doing that, as Wright was pointing out yesterday. But eventually, you would hope to get these phases. Once you got those phases, you got the single particle diffraction pattern. So, sure.
Now, the last expression is written there.
This one here?
No.
This one here?
No, below that.
Below that. This one here?
Now, you are after that because of the exponentials, they're different for different m, they have a jump, right?
No. That's just a Fourier.
I just Fourier transform that.
Yeah. With respect to delta phi.
Right. Yeah. So it would be a function of m only.
Think of it as a Fourier series, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just taking C2
index m
and e to the minus I m whatever
the,
delta phi
coefficients on that series.
Sum over delta phi, and this is a function of just of m.
Okay.
Yeah.
But there is an assumption involved in making this proportional to the number of particles, right?
No, I don't think so. I went through the algebra. It's exact. I mean, assuming that the random phase terms cancel out.
Yeah.
Right. So, but that's a reasonable assumption.
So
yeah.
Is that where you lose information about the phase?
That may be. Maybe. But as I will show, it is possible to recover those phases once you know the amplitudes. This is the whole point of Wright's talk yesterday. Okay, but I'll come to that in a minute. So you can't, I mean, there's no free lunch. You have to lose something along the way. Right? Yeah, sorry.
The way you recover this phase is already arbitrary to common rotation factor, right?
So right, he always has that ambiguity. You can put.
Yeah. Right. So you're going to recover a single particle pattern, but that could be in any orientation. It's like when you take the square root, you have a random phase. Okay, that's unimportant. What orientation the recovered, diffraction pattern comes in.
Yeah, but okay. Each of your rings will have its own.
I'm coming to that. Yeah, that's a very good point. So this is done on one ring at a time, so you need to get the proper registry between the different rings. Okay. All right. So the one principle is that is that you can recover the phases by one of these iterative phasing algorithms. That's that point. Now, about the registry of the rings, let me write this expression here. This is an expression for Q, Q prime, delta phi. This is why I made it general. I allowed there to be different rings here. Now, the point is that even if there are different rings, this quantity is measurable from experiment. So you would form the angular correlation between the intensities at one ring, Q, and the intensities at another ring, Q prime, and that's an experimentally accessible quantity, which means that if you keep the Q and Q prime separate, you can get this product here. Now, the point is this. Suppose I was right, and I could get the IM coefficients for one ring from here. The quantity on the left is an experimentally accessible quantity. So I can get the IMs for another ring by just dividing. So IM of Q prime, say, is like this Fourier transform, which is an experimental quantity, divided by NP times IM of Q. Maybe there's a complex conjugate here too. So that's how you get the registry between the different rings. So what this means is you really only need to phase one of the rings, because you can get the values of the second harmonic expansion coefficient for the other rings by just taking this experimental quantity here and dividing out. Right? That's crucial. There may be other ways of doing this, but at least this is the way we did it.
So
yeah.
Sorry to keep interrupting, but
sure.
P varies from short to short, right?
I'm sorry?
From sample to sample. When you move
what varies?
MP, the number of particles.
Ah, yeah, yeah. So it's not a very strong dependence. So you have to divide by some average. So you try and focus each diffraction pattern comes from roughly the same area, and you assume the statistical properties are such that you have roughly the same number of proteins.
But is it conceivable to determine for each how many and what NP actually was?
You can probably do that too by counting the scattered photons. Yeah, you can probably do that too. Okay. So that's the idea, that you can go through this whole procedure, and here is the a rough idea of this phasing algorithm, and here are the results that we obtained. Now this is let's say a simulation of a diffraction pattern from this potassium channel protein I mentioned. So we took the atomic coordinates from the protein data bank and put it in this orientation such that the X-rays were going down the pore, calculated the diffraction pattern, and it looks like this. Now we took copies of this with random orientations and added 10 of these with random orientations. We could add 100, it doesn't really, not very crucial on the number, but we did it for 10 for this simulation. The resulting pattern looks like that. It looks like a set of rings. It's not surprising, right? Because that's the only, because
so,
this angle.
So to speak, one ensemble member, it's one of these patterns.
This particular pattern is one of the ensemble, but we repeated this for about 100 diffraction patterns, each with different random angles, okay? Okay, so we have this pattern, and we have another 99 of these. And from that set, we can form these correlation functions, the C2 correlation functions. From that, we can recover the magnitudes of the IM coefficients for one particular ring. We can recover the phases by going through some kind of phasing algorithm. And you can get the registry between the different rings. You can get all the rings across like this. And you can reconstruct what results. And the result is the one shown here. And if you compare the one on the right here with the one on the left, which was the original single particle diffraction pattern, you see there's a lot of similarity. Of course, the random angle is different. I mean, it's got a different orientation that we can't control, but it's unimportant. Right? The protein comes out in some random orientation. But much more important is the relative intensities of different angles.
Yeah.
I actually calculated this diffraction pattern, and I added to it diffraction patterns with random angles.
Sorry. Interference between.
Interference. Okay. 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 I admit in the original calculation we did, we added in intensities, but I will show you in a minute. It actually doesn't matter. You can add amplitudes, and due to the random phases, you get the same answer. I'll show you that in a minute.
There's one case, LC would be completely covalent.
Yeah. I agree. This is an important question, but this is why I went through this algebra with amplitudes. So I assumed amplitudes, and yet because of the random angles, the cross terms vanish. So you essentially get a sum of intensities. And that's why you get this factor of NP and the intensity coefficient.
Since your calculation suggests that the coherent illumination versus partial coherent illumination will get the same result.
Yes.
Partial coherent will get the same result.
Yes, I agree. So, I completely agree.
Yeah.
To convince you of that, I have to go through the algebra, which probably haven't got time here. But I'll show you some results. Okay, so at least for this thing, we are able to recover essentially the single particle diffraction pattern. So it's like, as I say, it's like unscrambling an egg. So, okay. One other important point, which I almost forgot in my talk at the conference. It is important that these patterns be measured with X-ray pulses which are shorter than the rotational diffusion time of the molecules. Because if you don't do that, the diffraction pattern from an individual molecule will itself be this ring pattern. So what we want is that the diffraction pattern of the individual particles have some angular dependence, and then you sum over our random orientations.
Only one frozen in this order.
Yeah.
Right.
It will still work, right?
It will still work,
right? Right. There are two ways. As I say, it's got to be. It can be, either with the pulse length shorter than the rotational diffusion time for things that are vibrating or rotating, or you can freeze the particles in an ice sheet, in which case all you have to do is focus on one part and go to another part and go to another part to get the statistical properties. Okay. Then the time of the pulse is unimportant. You're right. If it's frozen, yeah.
But that must be picoseconds or longer, right? You're talking about.
Right. It's easy to achieve with modern X-ray sources. Yeah.
This channel molecule, it's embedded into membrane.
Yes.
Is it still able to rotate?
They do. So if you're doing it on a real membrane,
but it's on nanoseconds smaller.
Doing it on a real membrane, you need relatively short pulse radiation. Okay, but this shows. Yeah.
So why? I'm just curious. Yeah, so sure. Why can it rotate but not move up or down?
Because the membrane is a liquid, it's a fluid membrane in
two dimensions.
Just a viscosity associated with that. Okay. Going up and down would
break it right out of the membrane.
Of course, you have undulations of the whole thing.
The molecule height is about the same as the width of the membrane, so it doesn't make sense, right? Well, up and down, you get right out of the membrane.
Its position on the membrane, is it the ocean with the other?
There can be interaction, but I think there's a parameter window for, ideal gas kind of two-dimension. Short length, you have some fractions, and of course, there are proteins that activate the small patches, but not all of them do. I think that would be a window.
Okay, so the whole point of getting the single particle diffraction pattern is, of course, to go to the structure. Now, as I said, in this projection, since we only have a single diffraction pattern, all you can expect is the projected electron density. And if you do a phasing, I've probably done a rather crude phasing, probably White's algorithms can do much better than this, but you get the essential features of this molecule, that it's a square molecule. It's got a hole in the middle, that's the ion channel, and it's got this X-shaped feature that you see on here. So if you go through this process, you add together 10 of these patterns, produce this ring pattern, and then you unscramble it, get this pattern, and then do the phasing on this one, you get this. Essentially the same to this kind of resolution. Now, probably we can do better. As I said, my phasing algorithms are be crude. So, yeah.
How do I know if there's a hole in the meaning?
Okay. Okay, but it's roughly that. Yeah, okay. It looks like there are five holes. Well, there are kind of five holes in this pattern, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, roughly. So this is low resolution. I'm not expecting a lot from it. But at least it gives you the shape of the molecule and gives you the essential features. Now, we can probably do better, as I said, if you use a more sophisticated phasing algorithm. But so far, we've done that. Now, maybe just to close, I want to tell you that this has been done experimentally. This isn't all theory. So John Spence had this great idea that you could go to a shop and buy these nanorods, like 80 nanometer by 20 nanometer rods, and put them on a silicon nitride substrate and shine X-rays down it. So this is a rough approximation to the kind of membrane protein experiment, except that at a larger scale. And what kind of diffraction pattern would you expect? Well, you expect this kind of ring pattern. Now, this kind of pattern has been studied a lot in diffraction physics. This is called the small angle X-ray scattering pattern, or Sachs pattern. In the past, people have thought that due to this rotational averaging, the only information that you can really recover from that is the radial variation of intensities, i.e. as a function of magnitude of Q. And that's what the study of small angle X-ray scattering is all about, taking that I of Q distribution and from it recovering some whatever information you can recover about the pattern. Now, my point is that if you actually look at the angular correlations on these rings, although they're not maybe completely obvious to the naked eye, because you're subtracting off the mean and trying to get at the correlations, there is extra information in these patterns, this kind of pattern. And so by evaluating this pair correlation function, you can get that extra information. This extra information will allow you to get extra information about the individual particle. Okay, so that okay. So this is a real experimental thing. So from that ring pattern, we went through our procedure, and we recovered. So this is a simulation. This is still a simulation. I'll go through the experiment.
Can I ask you another question?
Yeah.
How accurately do you have to define the rings in that pattern? Because for this thing to work, you have to really figure out what the means are for each keyword. So yeah. It's maybe not so trivial depending on...
No, I think this is well understood.
It's easier.
It's just the angle of scattering. Yeah. Determined by the angle of scattering.
Centers, you have very good algorithms.
Yeah.
Even if you're scattering a blob, normal structure factor kind of sharp things, you know exactly
okay.
Sub-pixel resolution already.
Yeah.
Could you do similar correlation functions between different angles? And justify the same sort of correlation functions with phi prime, and if you have a completely random.
We are.
Correlations between the rings? You could also form the correlations between slices, no? Random slices.
And that's what we're doing. So this is at angle phi j. This is at angle phi j plus delta phi.
Maybe
yeah?
Just asking about
different Qs.
Yeah.
Different Qs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Different Q and Q. The correlation across with Q.
Because
maybe.
Or we could even solve more random.
I'm not sure that's very helpful. Because the crucial point here is that there's rotational symmetry. I mean, the particles have the same structure, rotational structure, but they're just in different orientation. So that's a case where angular correlation is very useful.
Of course, if you had a column of particles, along would be more. So like in a line along with them, then probably you would like to take a
decomposition. The mysterious step that we're skipping, where cancellation of exponential factors.
If you like, I can go through that.
Due to the fact that it's sampling a very uniform distribution of random orientation.
But by averaging.
Analog of that with the Q and what you're asking about.
You can have a sample which has particles along a line.
Along the
X-ray? Yes.
I mean, that one has. This is
a
projection. You mean along the.
and when you'll be interested in positions of these particles.
Okay.
You have no depth information, right?
You don't have any.
If you have single particles along the beam.
Yeah, you're talking about a one-dimensional situation. Yeah. Okay. That's possible, but it's not very physical. Well, maybe there are situations where that helps, but it doesn't help us solve this problem. Okay, so here is the diffraction pattern recovered from that ring pattern. This is from a real experiment. And then you apply a phasing algorithm, and here's another power of these phasing algorithms. Even though you have no information in this central ring, which is where the beam stop was, by running the phasing algorithm and allowing the intensities here to float in the course of the algorithm, you can actually fill in roughly the information in this beam stop. And at the same time, you recover a real space image, and this is a real space image we recovered, which is roughly an 80 nanometer long, 20 nanometer wide projection of the electron density of the particle in the experiment.
Can you see how you feel
in the beam stop? Okay, sure. So the essence of these phasing algorithms is the following. You take a set of experimental intensities and you take its Fourier transform. Right. So this gives you when you start with random let me see. So we're taking a Fourier transform here of the correlations, the C2 function, and we are trying to recover the intensity here. Now, if there is missing data in the correlation function, which there certainly is in the region of the beam stop, then you take a Fourier transform here. This will fill in the information in the missing beam stop because of the properties of Fourier transforms that, there's no reason for it not to put in data here. Now, at the next step, you constrain these intensities in the regions, where the intensities are known, or the correlations, the C2s are known in a certain region. This is wrong. So you get some I. Yeah. You don't do anything in the. Right. You don't know anything in the region where the intensities are not known. You just leave it and rely on the fact that the information in the known parts somehow propagates into the unknown part because you're doing Fourier transforms, continuous Fourier transforms.
We actually captured paper in PRL in 2005 to study the missing center. This is actually not a trivial problem. The reason is that if you think about a Fourier transform, the low frequency information independent from high frequency. In theory, you cannot get a high frequency information only from high frequency information to low frequency. Only some special case one can. And in quantum cryptography, we usually cannot measure F0, 0, 0. F0, 0, 0 corresponds to the central black P. That corresponds to the DC term. If you do Fourier transform the central pixel, that only corresponds to the central pixel that corresponds to the integral floating gas density. So that's just telling you the high rate, not the structure information. In principle, nowadays, we found only the missing, especially for experiment data, only the missing center is confined within spectral.
So I don't know. I mean, maybe this worked because this missing part is relatively small.
Yeah. Why is this only 20 nanometers?
Yeah.
And then, maybe. This is only the flow. I mean,
Yeah. This is the power of this algorithm. Even if you have missing data, it's capable of filling in the missing data because of this oversampling. Because, you know, you're giving it more information that way.
If your algorithm was successful in finding the missing, I think it's only successful because the object is small compared to the whole field of view.
That may be.
It means that you have high-frequency components,
yeah.
The important ones,
yeah.
And the low-frequency ones.
Right.
It's what Jonathan said. You want few speckles, maybe just one, to be in that missing area. Because, you know, a speckle represents pretty, the highly correlated intensity difference, like 1 degree of freedom. But if you have many speckles fit inside that beanstalk, there's a lot of undetermined parameters.
Yeah, but I think what Sergei is saying is also right. We have separation of, the experimental field of view and the field of view where you know what the data is, and then the unconstrained modes that you may have, because the eventual spectral size is smaller, you kill them by constraints. You know that's not interesting.
So you may not know exactly
what the object is. No. That's also important.
And you don't allow global, background.
Right. That's also important. As White pointed out yesterday, this object could be anywhere, and it gives you rise to the same diffraction pattern. So actually, in this version of the algorithm that I have been using, I have not been applying a support constraint. I've been allowing this thing to be reconstructed anywhere. This is by chance it appeared here. but this is we're getting into details of the algorithm here.
So these nanorocks, they might not be cylindrically symmetric. They might be like this, right? If this is the plane, they might be like this.
I see.
It's so, point to actually just get atomic resolution lines are.
Right.
It's just orientation.
So as I said, this is all restricted to particles that are related by rotation about an axis which is parallel to the incident X-rays. This analysis.
It might be also cylindrical, no. Symmetric like this.
It might be. But this is why in the X-ray experiment, John Spence took these tiny nanorods which he bought from a catalog, and he put it on a silicon nitride substrate, and he made use of gravity, I guess, to make sure that they're all parallel to the to the substrate,
like,
and so they don't tilt this way in the experiment.
I think what you're referring to is the possible different orientations about the actual nanorod axis, right? So you're talking about this.
I see.
On the membrane, and they differently oriented like this. On the membrane,
it could be like this.
So they can be in this orientation, right?
But
you're talking about this orientation.
Possibly something like a bifold symmetry. I think some of these nanorods are pie-like slices that are pieced together, that you have overall a fivefold symmetry.
Yeah.
So that means
that's a good point. So I've been concentrating on this geometry where the particles are rotated. Yeah, by random angles about the incident beam axis. But this is not the only orientation that one can do this kind of trick.
Substrate you have is presumably at last, right? Not a single crystal.
It will have Bragg spots.
Directions.
Yeah.
But you also will have preferred directions for orientation of the roads.
Although these are
silicon
nitride. Remember the scale.
But why there are no preferred orientations? So it's not atomically smooth.
The nanorods are so large.
They're large compared with atomic dimensions.
And then you have to be disordered. The interface is a little disordered.
Okay, so it's not atomically smooth.
It's not like UHD science where molecules are constructed surface locks into some epitaxial. It really would be very fascinating if you could show a correlation or surface field, you could align them.
So it's roughly 50 nanometers, which is 500 angstroms, which is 500 atoms wide.
Yeah.
Okay. So so I hope I've convinced you that it is possible in this configuration to, in principle, recover the diffraction pattern and to recover the structure of the particle through a phasing algorithm.
Is it, you say that those are metallic nanorods, so which metal is it?
I think it's gold, actually.
Ah, gold.
Yeah.
So it's very heavy.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Very
yeah.
So do
you have some more? You have to ask John Spence, I've not seen this. just to close, I want to point out one important thing. Suppose that the counts on each individual diffraction pattern is so low that they are distributed according to Poisson statistics. The question is, would the correlation function survive? By the time you do the average over all the diffraction patterns, do you recover a physically meaningful quantity if you have counts that are determined by Poisson statistics? So here's the essence of Poisson statistics. It tells you the probability of a count n given a certain average value lambda.
So just a second.
Yeah.
So what's the basis for assuming Poisson statistics?
Just counting statistics. I don't know.
Various.
But okay. But I think in any statistics that can be written in this form, this holds for. Okay, so I want to say that it doesn't depend on the details of Poisson. You can use any function here, so long as the value n is determined by some mean value lambda. Now, the definition of the mean count is that you multiply the actual value n by the probability and sum it over from 0 to infinity, and that should give you the mean count. Now, in a correlation function, what you do is you multiply two intensities together. So it's important to know whether the product of two such quantities, which are Poisson distributed, when you average this over a large number of diffraction patterns, will recover the product of the means. And I think this argument this convinces me that it does. Because so suppose that in one of those angles phi, that the count is m, in the other angle phi, the count is n. Well, the m, of course, the n is distributed according to this formula and the m according to that. And this nicely factorizes into sum over n of this quantity, sum over m of that quantity. And this is just the average value of this intensity at that position. And this is the expected value of the intensity at the other position. So I think what this shows is that if you average over a large number of diffraction patterns, you recover the correct products that you need for the theoretical expressions for the correlation function. So noise, I think, is not a problem.
You assume that these variables are independent. Yes.
Sure. Sure. Right. They're determined by the theoretical values lambda 1 and lambda 2 and nothing else.
Yeah. Independent by quantum process, which turns photon into electrons, and when you have 2 pixels, radiation 0, right, you're turning those photons into electrons, which are times the independence of the quantum process is taking place in those 2 pixels, and that, is not
Okay, sure.
I know that it's already.
Yeah, yeah. But the nice thing is, I think noise is not a problem.
No, the assumption that the joint distribution of, so many n in one detector pixel and n in the other detector pixel, that joint distribution is independent. There's some physics, right? It's really kind of trivial. The quantum process happening in this detector pixel, which turns radiation field into electron, and then another pixel, which does the same thing. But those are independent.
Right, but you see, I think that's what I was asking about the Poisson distribution.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a reason to expect photon statistics based on the nature of the radiation you're using. And that's then it's the same nature of the radiation you're using for pixel A and for pixel B.
Mm-hmm.
So photon statistics
based on the radiation field you're using, would automatically lead to potential correlations to the degrees of A and B.
How much of that
survives? Well, I don't know, but I don't think
it's
a difference.
It's just a,
he's got a lambda 1 or a lambda 2.
Yeah.
He means photon flux into the 2 pixels.
Yeah.
Those could be correlated. He's not saying that.
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
just saying, you know,
I'm trying to recover
it. Heard it into right. photons in an AM.
I mean, those quantities, lambda 1 and lambda 2, are the things I'm trying to recover, because these are the things that are related to the theoretical quantities.
There is another statistics coming in, the statistics of photoelectrons being produced by the detector.
Right.
That is shown.
Right, but there too. Well, that's all he's talking about. All he's talking about is
far. Yeah, I understand.
But there are photon counter detectors that we need light for them, right? And then we really know the photons.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I think the good news is I think this survives even if you have relatively low photon counts per diffraction pattern, provided you do the averaging of a large enough number of diffraction patterns. Just to conclude, this is not the only way to do it. You don't have to use a circular harmonic expansion distribution. There may be better ways to do it. For instance, the so-called Zernike function expansion. But the Zernike function is a set of basis functions for the expansion of a set of intensities over the unit disk. Now this, here's an example. Suppose we have a general 2D intensity distribution that looks like this. The basic Zernike function Z0, Z1, Z2 are given here. This can be represented by some linear combination of these. And you see, you don't need, for at least a simple pattern like this, you don't need that many Zernike functions. By adding up about 8 of these basis functions, you can reproduce essentially this pattern. Now, the advantage of using a Zernike function rather than these spherical harmonic, these circular harmonic distributions, is that the Zernike function gives you, provided you get the coefficients of these Zernike functions, you have the full 2D intensity distribution. You don't have to do one ring at a time and then find the correlations between the rings. So I think possibly this might allow you to use less experimental data.
So are these well known in this field? They look like the normal modes of vibration.
Something like that, yeah. So, right, you know. Right. I think, yeah.
Do you mean just Bessel functions?
I can't remember the details, but yeah, you're right. I think they involve Bessel functions.
Anyway,
yeah.
Well known.
Yeah, yeah, okay, fine. But it's known that it's known. Yeah.
I'm not saying.
They're not that well known in this field, but I think the use of these functions might help this analysis. So that's just a point.
Z1 and Z2 doesn't look like a best expansion, right? It's a different function sets, probably.
Well, yeah. I can't remember the details actually.
In a special case, you take the angular function is just a cosine, right? Cosine theta times equals x, right? So it's just a conjugate plot of x.
So just to show that I think this is practical, here is a that K-channel diffraction pattern that I simulated. This one here, and I actually approximated this with about 1,000 Zernike functions, and it reproduces the pattern pretty well. So this might really be a practical method, but we're still working on the details. Let's stop here. I think my time is up. Okay.
Before I forget, there was some discussion here that I missed about the basically the soft matter nature of proteins.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, so we've had 40 years of molecular dynamic simulations, which now can make poses of proteins when you do drug design and so forth. But there is one issue that the MD people seem to always worry about, and that's water and acid. It's in vivo, of course. And they speak about crystallographic water,
right,
which shows up when you do a standard
crystallography. Yeah.
Because the water molecule stays in each element.
Right.
And then there is solution water,
right,
which is noise.
Yeah.
And so there's always a discussion when we do simulations what role does solution water play?
Right, right.
So that raises a lot of issues about when you deal with one protein, what do you really want to deal with? Or more to the maybe more important nanocrystals, what do you want to do with a nanocrystal?
Yeah, I think this is a...
You know, it's very easy to get acid water in and out.
Yeah, these are good questions, but we are far away from this because at this resolution, you know, we don't see anywhere near, nowhere near the size of the water molecule here. We're just trying to get the overall shape of the protein and some gross features.
But the goal will eventually.
Eventually, eventually. And I believe that using, you know, more sophisticated phasing algorithms, we'll get a lot more detail. You know, I want to talk to White about that.
The preparation of the protein itself is, I think Ralph had mentioned, these are ensembles of molecules.
Yes, yes.
And the protonation states of the various residues are very sensitive to conditions. So how to define protein is a whole lot.
So actually, I want to point out this one thing here. All the particles do not have to be completely identical. Because of this is kind of linear theory, if the particles have slight variations in size or something like that, what you recover is as an average particle. So here's a simulation we did where we assumed a 10% range of sizes of these nanorods. And this is the diffraction pattern we recovered, and you know, going through the phasing algorithm, we still recovered essentially the correct shape, at least at this resolution. So the particles don't have to be absolutely identical. So you're allowed some little bit of slop here.
But if you have
and you recover some kind of average.
But if you have something like A phase and B phase DNA, I mean, these are completely different.
Right. They're completely different.
Really prepare,
unravel a mix. Sure. Absolutely. I agree. If they're completely different, it probably makes the average makes no sense.
The related thing that the theorists and that community are looking towards is co-crystallization studies. Where the nanocrystals will be of considerable interest, because you can get another solution in and out of there if you want to have a ligand that's a candidate for drug design and get it into an active site of a small enzyme crystal. That's extremely valuable information, and the crystallography is now doing more and more crystallization study, it seems it will be much easier, faster, better in the nanocrystal regime. I'm stressing again this idea of starting to think about how the targets will be prepared and some thought directed that has not started.
So the idea of this work is somehow to get away from crystallization altogether. So these are molecules that are moving around, hopefully in kind of more natural environment, like a liquid or something like that. Of course, I've only demonstrated it for orientation about a single axis at the moment.
Yeah, I'm not looking minimizing what you've done. And this issue of the molecule relaxing in solution is why we started doing molecular dynamics simulation, because the structure in the crystal is quite different than in
Sure. But this might allow you to find the, you know, the...
One contribution MD has given us, even with really crazy force models in the protein, is the relaxation.
Yes.
Of the protein into solution conditions, physiological conditions.
Right. So the crucial point here is that we are going away from the crystallography model, right? So if you can determine the structures of molecules in this kind of more disordered orientation situation, we can actually get experimental evidence for, you know, different conformations in this. And because you're averaging, actually, the final image is some kind of average over all the conformations. They don't have to be absolutely identical.
How much hope is it to generalize it to a 3D?
I have some. I did prepare some slides on that. I'll just say verbally. So for complete random orientations in 3D, which is what you would expect of protein molecules in a liquid, you have to, the algebra gets a lot more complicated. Instead of using these circular harmonic expansions, you have to use spherical harmonic expansions and allow completely random orientations using, you know, Wigner D rotation matrices and things like that. So the algebra definitely becomes more complicated, and I must say I haven't got all the way to the solution in that case, but we're working on it. We've got some ideas. Again, this Zernike function expansion may be one of the keys, actually, because I think you need less information to get the appropriate Zernike function expansion. You don't need information on all the rings. You just do one ring and you should get the whole pattern, if presumably. But we're working on that. Now, there's a 3D equivalent of this also, of these Zernike functions, 3D Zernike functions. Yeah.
So just from my own understanding, to put this into context, so how large is the interest in, say, membrane, protein, imaging at the resolution of, I don't know, 5-6 angstroms or so? Okay. Is that something that cannot be done any other way? Or are there, say, TEM-type measurements that would work on a membrane to reasonable resolution, maybe at least 10 angstroms or so? I mean, this is a name that's never been known. Just can you put it into the context of maybe other techniques and the need for, say, 5 or 6 angstrom resolution?
Tim would know better.
I think if you can, if we show that if you reach that, you could target a number of meaningful problems. The question is,
as you say, at the moment you cannot.
Well, you can do 2D electron microscopy, and again you take images of many copies, and but they do really image that separately, like Porteo or Dobson, they started to work, Henderson, and there was. There's one strong competition now that. You can use lipid cubic crystals to crystallize membrane proteins. That has been pioneered. They stay in their intact lipid environment, but then the lipid rather forming vesicles forms a cubic structure. I think the number of membrane protein structures deposited in the database has gone up. There's some work also with AFM to see like contours, beautiful work, again, not a projection and just not, you know, Z resolutions really, but you know, just in the plane.
So you would say at the moment taking a membrane and imaging a couple of membrane proteins is not feasible? No one has.
It requires a lot of effort.
It's very nice to see interactions and physiological readings.
So it has not happened? People have not been able to do.
No, but let's say that for many drug design problems, you really need high resolution. This competition of crystallizing in a liquid phase is really strong.
Yeah, either that or if we can improve the resolution by using better phasing algorithms, that might also.
Like they wouldn't have been able to figure out the mechanism of how this crazy thing is able to filter sodium from potassium without, you know, that very high resolution.
Yeah.
It was a heroic effort, you know, they had to crystallize parts of the thing and then.
There's also another very strong competition which one should mention, that solid state NMR. This is also
They're all involved in working at quite a bit longer. They're getting better. I thought that also was in a sense limited to some smaller proteins. Would these membrane proteins be considered large or small?
Yeah, these are large proteins.
But there's also very rapid development in that solid state NMR field. So there are already membrane proteins.
All this concern about the Poisson distribution, I think you don't even need that.
Yeah, right. You can use any kind.
Variables.
Exactly.
Distribution could be anything.
Yeah. I didn't need the particular form of the Poisson distribution.
But you don't even have to put a form down. Independent of the distributions, whatever they are, it will give you the same result.
Okay.
So that's really the assumption.
So that's all that matters to be able to make that correlation analysis. So that's basically what you were trying to accomplish.
Yeah, but the question I was asking is, if you got very weak diffraction patterns with, you know, just single counts or something like that, a lot of a statistical variation, would it help to average the data from a large number of diffraction patterns? Does that converge to a meaningful physical quantity? And I think it does. In just the same way that if you took individual counts and average a large number of them, it converges to the mean, which is the meaningful quantity.
Question for more people. And to come back to this factor of 20, those improvement compared to LCRs, reasonable LCRs versus polyhistology. Now, as I remember, in the 2002 Nature paper, they assumed 10 to 12 photons focus down to a spot of 100 by 100 nanometers. So if you calculate that corresponds about 10 to 6 photons per angstrom squared, right? So it seems like a 6 photonic crystallography, they probably, if you add a few photons per angstrom squared.
For sure.
Less than one. So yes, 6 orders kind of different.
Right, that's what I mean, that it's very different how the energy gets dumped into the system. In proton crystallography, it's kind of spread out over a lot of time. You have ways to kind of dissipate the energy.
So my question for you, so it seems that based on recent results, only improved factor 20, which means only 20 photons per angstrom squared is okay. But after that, so the question for you is, of course, right now the energy 2 keV, eventually people are going to use 8 keV or 10 keV. But based on AMO so far, the experimental results.
But I think John Spence's experiment was with, say, around 10 to 12 protons focused to a micron squared. So, I mean, it's not exactly the same as in Haidu's case, but he also had much higher absorption cross sections. Yeah. So I think the situation as far as radiation damage is concerned is in a sense similar, but it is lower resolution.
That's
so,
the point. But he said, based on his studies, he found an improved factor of 20.
Yeah, I asked him the other day, how much lower a flux do you need to...
The point is much lower. So we only detect damage. Things have changed on a scale of 6.
Resolution lower, which means better, more favorable. So if the resolution is high, more difficult.
Of course, yeah. And this is a discrepancy, the basic discrepancy between Neutze or Haidu, the simulation, which was in short KV, and the experimental results now.
This is the main orders difference. I mean, it's not just like
I think the damage is measured with respect to the resolution, of course. If things move or change on the scale of your wavelength, then you start to see damage. And since it was only a 2 keV right now, the experiments, you have a much higher tolerance for damage than you had in the Haidu simulation, which was at 12 keV.
There was the same thing with the flash experiment. You could see the stick figures before they exploded. Was of course because it was made no resolution.
And this refers to electronic damage as well as ionic damage. Both will be kind of changed, of course, if you look only at 6 angstrom or whatever.
But I would like to understand what you think is the discrepancy between Neutze and John Spencer.
Well, it's a recent experiment. It's a recent experiment. It indicated we can get it, but at least from John Spencer's talk. I haven't asked him to talk about this problem. Well, he said it can compare to the Henderson criterion. Henderson criterion, you can see, is polyhistology criterion. How about a few photons per angstrom squared? Let's assume a few photons per angstrom cubed squared.
Total or per shot? I mean, what is the damage threshold?
Well, polyhistology typically, if you
total.
Total,
not per shot.
Polyhistology
not
is
what? In total, over many shots. Well,
then over how many?
Continuous.
It's a synchrotron in CW. I mean,
total.
There's no shot.
A few photons per angstrom squared. That's about that.
So then I think how many shots? The confusion probably comes from what John actually meant by his threshold. Because if you say the threshold is a few photons per angstrom squared, and in the Neutze paper they effectively have 10 to the 12 photons into 1,000 angstrom squared area, actually,
So right, I mean, if you have 100 nanometer focus, then that's 1,000 angstroms. So it's actually just 100 photons per angstrom squared, then in the Leipzig paper. 100 angstroms.
Can be 12 photons, but not 100 nanometer, 100 nanometer squared.
112 into 1,000 angstroms squared.
Yeah, 10
to 6. So that's 10 to the 6. Yeah,
10 to 6 photons per angstrom squared. So my question is, so far you have AM experiments and some nanocrystal experiments. So far, those 2 KV. Based on your data, I don't know whether one can do extrapolation. And what's the number that is so far, based on experiment, that we can get? How many photons per angstrom cube that sample can tolerate, or atom can tolerate?
We calculated that.
Yeah,
right?
How many?
Well, it depends on the pulse length. You also, course, expose that, then makes a big difference, and on temper effects. So you can gain order of magnitude. There's a lot of room for improvement, so to speak. And you cannot say, okay, this is what it tolerates, because it really depends on the situation quite a bit.
Well, that was John's main point. He didn't see any damage for pulses shorter than 200
right.
femtoseconds.
Right.
That was
because things don't move. And the electronic damage is very fast, but this is a matter of resolution. If you look only within 6 angstrom, then you need to lose electron density out of this 6 angstrom cube, whatever, yeah? And this doesn't happen so fast. Of course, it happens on a smaller time scale very fast, because you make holes and things, and the electron density changes a little bit. But on a 6 angstrom, whatever volume, it doesn't change so fast.
But what is surprising is this discrepancy you're referring to.
Okay, why
is
that?
That's why he's supposed to talk about that.
Yeah,
I'm not sure, because basically, as far as the number of photons goes, we're talking about 20 to the 12 or so photons in the LCLS pulse. Maybe a little less, but roughly 10 to the 12. And it was focused to a micron. So you lose, say, just 2 orders of magnitude in the gluons. It's not 10 to the 6, but 10 to the 4 photons per angstrom squared. But because the cross sections are higher at 2 keV for a biological sample, right when you go up in photon energy, then the cross section goes down, but at 2 keV you have a higher cross section. And I think I once looked it up, it actually changes by exactly about a factor of 100 or so from 2 to 8 keV. And so, drops quickly, right? So it's this 1 over omega to 3.5, exactly. So that's why you get a substantial change in the cross section. So in other words, the amount of energy that the system absorbs at 2 keV at the LCLS conditions of a micron focus are not that different from what you would expect at 8 keV with a tighter focus. However, and that's what Jan Michael is pointing out, the resolution is different. Like, so whether you see the damage, even though you might be doing exactly the same amount of damage, whether you see it in the scattering pattern, that's easier at 8 keV than at 2 keV.
Stefan Hauri actually showed that. I'm still kind of trying to understand the curve, but I think it seems there's some change, but I don't know how to interpret it. I see angstrom could be a different angstrom.
And you also have to take into account that the initial simulation for hydrogen left out a lot of crystalline processes.
Yeah.
And most of them actually held. So it was very conservative for change.
Very conservative.
I don't think they should do that.
Very conservative.
Put it
in the very conservative means the.
I think the situation is better than, in general, it's better than what actually the hydrogen paper.
Well, you need to control it more for
yes.
Has anyone seen this recent preprint from Quinn? Newton?
No.
Yeah. So when you look, you should look that up on the preprint server. It's
the archive?
On the archive.
Okay.
And it's another paper that claims, and for different reasons than you do, that actually the situation is going to be a lot better than people have been anticipating so far as far as damage is concerned. And that they propose a different way to do the reconstruction. It's not so much a question of how to do phasing or so, but they rewrite the problem in a slightly different way. So I think anyone interested in imaging should probably take a look at that. It appeared, I think, 2 months ago or so on the archive, and I suspect they submitted it to Nature because it had that format.
Yeah.
Another one of these revolutions.
Yeah, what life was bothering for you.
Well, it becomes more important, sure. Well, at 2K views, it would be much more visible.
I know, is that worse?
No, I mean, it's still way less than a coherent
scale. You mean elastic?
Yes.
Which is
coherent is elastic scale. Right.
Well, in addition, they interact mostly with the K shell.
What?
The 8KeV, in the atoms you are interested in.
No, at 2KeV, they also interact predominantly with the K shell.
Yes.
The cross section is still much higher. but what happens is that.
But it depends on the atom.
But we're talking about quantum fields, which defines the atoms fairly.
Light elements.
Light is
10.
But the quantum cross section is still of the order of a one electron Thomson cross section, whereas the coherent cross section you gain this kind of factor 4 or 5 or 6 squared. So
right. That's good.
Yeah.
So the background is going to just come from scattering up the junk.
Because you have to go to gamma rays to worry about quantum.
Yeah, I think the
Yeah.